Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to the 132nd episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. And wishing happy Easter to all authorized. The URLs for the previous 131 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. My most recent column for the Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com, and Westchester Guardian is westchesterguardian.com. It includes the 199th column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the column, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. At the previous website that I mentioned, you can also find the links to the previous radio shows and to my online daily newspaper at my web home. And so once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. Next week's guest will be novelist and the New York Daily News columnist Dennis Hamill. Dennis will be followed the week after by historian and nonfiction writer Gail Lumet Buckley, author of the recently published The Black Calhouns, From Civil War to Civil Rights with One African-American Family. And now to this show. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. My guest tonight is author and science writer Pagan Kennedy. I first took note of Pagan's writing over 20 years ago when I read the New York Village Voice, and more recently by her book, Inventology, How We Dream Up Things to Change the World. Good evening, Pagan, and welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
An obvious question, and one that I'm sure you've dealt with many times. What's the background on your unusual first name?
Oh, yes. So here's the story. It's the details are a bit lost in the mists of memory. But in high school, the principal mentioned God at some point. And I was already a budding First Amendment defender, or I guess freedom of religion defender. And so I ran around the school saying that this was illegal and they couldn't mention God in school, and got all up in arms, and basically nobody cared, but my friend nicknamed me Pagan, and then the name kind of stuck, and I decided I liked it, and oddly it ended up being I certainly did not mean to do it as a career move back then. I was sort of a punk rock kid, I now have a very Googleable name, a very easy. I think I'm the only Pagan Kennedy on the internet.
How's your family handled the name change?
They got used to it. They had no choice but to accept it. So.
Let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Bethesda, Maryland, and I went to, I don't know, a bunch of schools, but at one point I did go to, our parents sent us to, my sister and I, to an Episcopalian school that was just, and there was a lot of Jesusing, and I think that was one reason why. So very young I decided that religion wasn't for me, and so I sort of that became something I was thinking about a lot as a little kid.
my cousins, the Crillies, the father was an eye surgeon, lived in Bethesda Chevy Chase area, first on Western Avenue near the Circle, and then in Bethesda proper near the Mormon Cathedral and the park. How far were you from either of those?
Pretty near, pretty near. It was so different. You know, I'm old, so this was back, I was born in the 60s. And, you know, when I grew up there, Bethesda was just kind of a collection of, you know, there wasn't much there. But now it's gotten very, very fancy in the, you know, like everything seems to have in on the East Coast.
When they downsized and moved from the very large house, because they had seven or eight on Western Avenue, my cousin's only stipulation was that they be no further from the country club that he belonged to than he was at the present. And his new house was just about equidistant. When did you first think of writing as the life's work?
That is a very good question. I knew that I loved to tell stories, and in college, I began to take writing classes, and I just loved it. I sort of dreamed of writing for the Village Voice even in college. And then something happened after I graduated. I had been writing short stories in, you know, for classes. And then a story just came out of me. It was this very weird experience when I was right out of college where I wasn't even trying to write a story. It just was day after day I kept hearing this kind of voice in my head, and I just was writing without didn't really have a choice. It just kind of was coming out of me. But at the same time, I was also really interested in chronicling what I was seeing around me too, not just in fiction but in nonfiction, and was really, really kind of fell in love. I had a deep and abiding crush on the Village Voice, which of course was in the 80s when I came along, was really in a magnificent paper. It was huge and fat and full of these like 20-page long crazy rants about culture and full of ideas and beautiful, crazy photographs and, you know, just the chronicler of downtown culture and underground culture. And so I actually managed to, just by being a relentlessly stalker of the Village Voice, managed to start working there at about the age of 22.
Boy, you're way ahead of me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get ahead.
That's okay. That's okay. You mentioned college, though. Where'd you go, and what was your field of study there?
So I went to Wesleyan. I actually went in as a biology major and was really kind of a life sciences nerd. But then when I got there, the sciences were very much, like, tracked to jobs, you know, so all the biology classes and chemistry classes were very tracked to pre-meds, and it was just, you know, I just was turned off by that. I was more just kind of in love with the cells and, you know, how what life was and all of that, and it was very much, you know, kind of the kind of situation where people were down front, you know, with their tape recorders, tape recording the lectures so they could pass the, you know, get, and, you know, you do want your doctors to be very studious, and that's totally cool. But I just was turned off from that. It was, I just felt like I wasn't going to get my questions answered anytime soon about what life was and things like that. And I got drawn away into American Studies, which I also fell in love with. That way of analyzing the world, of looking for the political and cultural DNA behind everything and seeing explanations, you know, looking at pop culture and thinking about it deeply. I just thought that was amazing. I mean, it was kind of like my mind opened up to this whole new way of talking about culture, and I became very excited about that. And so I was an American Studies major, and yeah.
Did you want to?
Oh, sorry,
no, go
which
ahead.
Is a great. It's a great. It's a great major for a journalist, I think, because you learn to think. Just seeing, you know, start to see everything through a political lens in a way that's really helpful.
Did you run across Kit Reed in any of your courses?
I never took a class with her, but she always seemed like a really lovely person and awesome writer.
Yeah, I've spoken to her a bunch of times, and she did some writing for Playboy when my oldest friend was the executive editor, and she was a favorite of an old acquaintance of mine, John Perry Barlow, the ex-Grateful Dead.
Okay, all right. Can we just have a Barlow moment here?
He refers to Kit as one of his heroes.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I just saw John Perry Barlow a couple weeks ago when I was in San Francisco. He lives in the basement of a friend of mine.
Oh, okay.
And unfortunately, he's had a lot of health problems, but he's still partying.
In the last year and a half or so.
Yeah.
I had one of my worst experiences. I was talking to him. I've known him for 20 years. So he was speaking at NYU at the time that we were all involved in the moves and in virtual or the non-visual online communities and in the well, and we did conferences, and so I went to this talk. And he had one of the great phrases, though. He also said that we have to learn to live in the world where the flesh becomes word. Which
oh,
I
wow.
thought was a terrific phrase. I mean, he's terrific with a phrase. So from outside after, then we're talking, and I knew that he was engaged and he was very happy. And then he told me that he had been about 4 or 5 months before, and I didn't know the story. He and his fiance had flown home from San Francisco on separate planes. And when he got home, the head of her, he waited, and she never showed up, and he finally contacted the airline, went out to Kennedy. She had died on the plane. She had an undetected heart problem.
Yeah, and I remember hearing about that story. That is just so sad.
He brought tears to my eyes. You know, was standing.
What is that phrase you said?
We must learn to live in a world where the flesh becomes word, which is exactly the opposite of the world of the word became flesh in the Gospel of St. John.
Yeah. Oh my God, I love that. I'm gonna mull that over for a while. That's really profound.
And as you know, he preceded you to Wesleyan.
Yeah.
And he was also the lyricist for the Grateful Dead. So he was all over the place. Did you write for publication while you were in college, or did you write for a college paper or anything?
I did write for college papers. Yeah. Somebody just put on, it's, you know, the world has gotten so weird because people post these things from your past that you had totally forgotten about. And you realize that our bits of us are scattered around, and we all have pieces of each other's memories in our houses, you know? So somebody posted, a few months ago, a piece I'd written in the college paper about the Church of the Subgenius. I don't know if you've heard of them, but they were a kind of sort of punk rock influenced, tongue-in-cheek, fake, but somewhat not fake, parody of a religion that was, it was actually very much of a kind of a pre-internet thing. it was like a community of people who were engaged in this sort of giant performance art and religion slash, you know, critique of everything that involved a lot of collage art and weird music. So I wrote about that movement.
There were no relation to that spaghetti monster religion.
It was something like that, but even if you can imagine people spending even a lot more time on it and publishing a Bible sort of thing, and yeah, making and forming little enclaves around the country.
You mentioned in the conversation a bit ago, and did note to me that you moved to New York after graduation, and you wrote for a number of publications before settling in with The Voice. How difficult was it to get started? That, and who gave you your first New York start?
Well, I moved. It was so hard for people even back in the 80s to find anywhere to live. So my first cheap place was in the basement of, over the summer, I lived in a frat basement. They were renting out rooms really cheap over the summer. And I was actually interning at the Columbia Journalism Review. So that's one place I started. And I actually got to write for them while I was there. But it turned out my roommate in the basement was a girl named Annie, and I'm forgetting her last name. But her mother worked in at the Village Voice. Just random. My dream was to be there, and it just by random accident, her mother was in the circulation department or something like that at the Village Voice and knew everybody. And so that's really how I got in. Was I got to know her mom, and her mom helped me, find the right people to start getting these jobs there. And I began kind of right away. I was doing a lot of freelance fact checking and freelance copy editing. And then I started to even write for them. I was very young when I was 22, 23. I was doing all of that.
Two former voice writers have been on previous episodes. Susan Brown Miller and Lucian Truscott. Did your voice career overlap with either of those?
I don't recognize their name. And on Facebook now, there's a Facebook group of people who worked at The Voice. And that's been really cool to see all these writers who I...
Susan Brown Miller was one of the original of feminist icons.
Right. Yes. Right.
And she wrote for The Voice for a number of years. And Lucian Truscott had written for The Voice while he was, which wasn't encouraged by the army.
Yeah.
And then he was, and his father had been a general, and his grandfather had been a general. He's a direct descendant of Thomas Jefferson. I'm sorry. Yes, of Thomas Jefferson. And he tried to have some cover up at his first post brought out for Department of the Army, and when they wouldn't, he was going to write for The Voice, and they actually threatened to send him to Vietnam, and his father was on the on the line, and he said it is against the law to punish a person by sending him into the combat zone. He eventually resigned from the army, but he has tried to get the Hemings clan into this Jefferson descendants society, whatever it is, and they won't let them in.
Yeah.
So he's been trying for 10 years, and he said they want all sorts of documentation. He said no one ever asked him for documentation. He showed up and then said, here I am, and I'm Lucian Truscott III, and blah, blah. And so he was fighting it. He's a very interesting guy. I understand from Susan that he just started writing for The Voice again.
Oh, goody. Good. Well, that's a great fight that he's putting in, and, you know, that really is so important to have, you know, the more inclusive sense of who the Jefferson family is and tell the story in a broader way. I remember going, my parents were very Southern, so I remember going to Monticello,
yes.
Jefferson's house, and you know, of course, the upstairs is so amazing with all his inventions and all this beautiful furniture, but when you go below and you see this, I was horrified as a child, because when you go underneath, there's the slave quarters underneath with chains hanging on the wall, and I remember being just almost traumatized as a child seeing that, you know, that people would be living this very beautiful life on one floor, and that there would be people in this horrific circumstances below. And so it's definitely a conversation needs to happen. And yeah, they do need to.
Many of the authors have written about that. It was true love on both their sides, him and her. But I could imagine if falling in love with him meant getting out of that basement you were talking about, getting upstairs, that might have been easy, no?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what does it mean to love across those kind of political and social, you know, divisions, that where one person is so much, has so much more than the other person. Yeah, I think that's really interesting.
Do you also publish your first short story with The Voice? So what was it, and what moved you in the fiction direction?
I actually was, when I started as a writer, it was a different world. I mean, you could make money off of fiction. It sounds crazy now, but I used to make money off my fiction, even my short stories. And The Voice would pay, Voice published short stories for a while. They had this literary supplement, and they'd actually pay me like, I don't know, $800, which was a fortune to me back then. So I actually, after I had worked for The Voice for a couple of years, I went to Johns Hopkins. I got a full, to the writing seminars program, I got a full scholarship and a stipend. So for me, it was a way to study and a way to live and write for a year. And while I was there, I wrote this story and sent it up to the literary supplement. And they took it, and that was my first story published in The Voice. I had published elsewhere. And then I began writing a lot more for the literary supplement. They really liked my work. And M. Mark was this editor who was just wonderful to me and was such a mentor and so kind to me. So that got me started. And I had the... It was also very odd back then to be able to write for a paper where you didn't live in the same city. But luckily, the fax machine was just coming into its own. So I was able to fax in stories or think pieces or whatever I was working on. And that was something that was really hard to do. You know, before that, you would have had to you would have had to send it through the mail, which often was too slow in the world of newspapers. So you often had to call things in, you know, and like read them on the phone. So it was a different world.
Yeah, I did the cover story for PC Migs, and it was the first story in PC about Apple computing, because that was a different platform than I'd been the president of the New York Apple User Group. And to get it into PC for the deadline, I had to drive in the blizzard from where I am down to the offices there. And when I was going to have Bill McCrone, who was the editor at the time on the radio show, he said, "Well, you know, I have something to do." And I said, "I drove in a snowstorm for you." And he said, "Okay. What time should I call?"
You risked your life to get that copy in.
Yeah, that was a different time. Yeah. I find short story writing the hardest because you have to do your characterization, have a plot, have an environment, all in a very short, limited space. It's not like the novel where you can go on like some of Greg Ilse's recent books up to 700 pages. You must have mastered the art to be able to get that.
Oh, that's kind of you. I don't know if I did. So you write fiction as well.
I have the book, the poetry that no one pays for, up on Amazon. And I also have a novella and some short stories up there. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, good for you.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't write fiction anymore. I sort of I've been a working writer all my life. I think as you have, and so there was a point at which the audience for fiction got so, or serious, or whatever, the kind of fiction I was writing, at least, seemed to get small, and it just got so much harder. But, you know, at the same time, I really began to fall in love with I'd already always done journalism and always seen it as a great counterpoint to fiction, but somewhere in the 90s, I really fell in love with nonfiction and nonfiction storytelling. And I think fiction is really hard because there's just no rules. Whereas, at least with a nonfiction story, you sort of have a sense of where the story has to go and who your character is, right?
You mentioned the masters. What made you decide to go back for a master's after already writing in the field?
Honestly, it was, you know, I was still in my 20s and really struggling to carve out enough time to write. And so at Hopkins, I was getting not just, amazing teachers like John Barth, but stipend so that I could live. It didn't cost very much to live down in Baltimore in those days. And so that was, I really saw it as a chance to just spend as much time as possible writing, which I was very driven to do.
Then it was off to Boston, where you both got into the zine culture, the predecessor to our current blogosphere. And freelance magazine writing. Would you describe zines for our audience?
Yeah. When I moved back up to Boston, or I had been in Boston just for a little bit before I went to Hopkins, and I had a lot of friends up there. And I moved back up in the late 80s. And so I sort of was toiling away on my novel as I simultaneously was writing for the Village Voice and other New York places. And around me, suddenly everybody else was doing media, but they were doing these Xeroxed magazines that, like, very limited run. I had a roommate, Donna Cossey, who was doing one called Kooks Magazine. She'd collect the rantings of crazy people and publish them with these great collages. And they were just, like, such creative things, but people were doing them for, just really for fun. And I was sort of taking myself very seriously and saying, my friends would all say, write something for my zine. And I'd say, no, I'm trying to finish my novel. But they were just having so much more fun than I was. That at a certain point, I kind of caught the bug, and I began doing my own zine, and it was just such an amazing world in the late 80s and early 90s, because it was so creative, and you would go to a party, and everybody would have their little, magazine they'd give you, and then you'd go home and read it, and which doesn't sound that special today because we all can do that with each other's blogs, but it was really new to me. And this idea of the blurring of your kind of real life and your life as, in writing was really enchanting, and this idea that you would have, that you would know all your readers was very cool, and that they would become involved in your project. You know, and again, that's all stuff we take for granted today, but back then it all seemed very strange and was even hard to explain to people.
What was the theme of your zine?
Mine was just about my life as a struggling writer and sort of in mock heroic terms and, you know, write about my whatever I was doing sort of in a funny way, I hope funny, and document everything that was going on. And, for instance, my friend and I went across country and I documented all that and took pictures and and that sounded really weird to people when you said, oh, I'm just doing a little magazine about my life. Again, that sounds completely normal now, but people just didn't get why you would do that back then.
Yeah, because there was obviously some precedent to that. If you go back to James Thurber and My World and Welcome to It,
yeah,
and things like that. Yeah.
Although he wasn't, you know, hand printing all his things and then handing them out to friends. That added a whole other.
For that, you have to go back to Benjamin Franklin.
Exactly. It was very Thomas Paine, Benjamin Franklin. Yes, it was very much like that. And, I was always would proudly say I'm in all the bathrooms of the group houses in around Boston. So.
Then what magazine were you writing for to pay the rent?
I was actually at this point, there was all these tech magazines coming up, like PC Week and Digital Review. So it was actually would work there as a copy editor part time, and I was writing for a lot of different magazines.
I had one of the founders of PC. The original founder of both PC and then PC World, and his name's gone right by.
Oh,
he's,
really?
He's a terrific person, and the fellow that he started PC Magazine with, the fellow sold it out from under him, and Ziff took it over, all of the staff walked out, and Ziff had to get a whole new staff, you know. So it was. It was very interesting.
Maybe I was the new staff. I don't know. I only worked for Ziff Publications for some reason. But it was a wonderful world working in those tech magazines in the early 90s because they supported a whole bunch of artists and writers and actors and, you know, all kinds of interesting people ended up there. And I made a lot of friends. Yeah.
What happened with Ziff was that they had all these bouquet publications, and one of them was Computers and they were successful, and then PC Magazine just wiped everything out, and it increased the demand on the publishers of the other magazines. And all of those, the photography magazines and Computers and Electronics, they all went away. They all got folded into PC.
Yeah, and then, of course, the web came along. And
killed those.
I was also in the a little later, among other things, I was writing books and doing all kinds of things. But one of my many jobs was working right when the web came along, I think 95. I got on early and I was really fascinated with it. And so got in early writing about it. But there was a magazine called The Web Magazine, and you read the magazine to know where to go on the web.
Okay.
Sounds nutty. I mean, because there weren't any good search engines yet.
Oh, sure. There were also, I mean, I was involved in that. My career was in technology, not in writing at that time. The writing was accidental, which was terrific. But there were people that made fortunes designing ugly, ugly web pages to grammar school kids do better than, you know, and everyone was, it was a wild time.
It was a really fascinating time. And then people were, do you remember people were afraid to go on the web? There was that Sandra Bullock movie, The Net, like this woman goes on the internet once I think she's murdered or something. People were really scared of it. Like you would go on and somehow people would come to your house and kill you or something. It was odd.
It was an interesting time. Now you mentioned book writing. You mentioned in your note to me that you got two early contracts, one for a short story collection and one for a book on pop culture. They sound very dissimilar. How did you keep both of them going at the same time?
Yeah, I had already written the story collection, and this was by the time I was about 30, and so I had accumulated a lot of stories at that point. But I simultaneously was desperate to leave my day job working. At this point, I was a little fed up with working for tech magazines, and so I also came up with a commercial book, nonfiction book idea to write a book on the 1970s, which was then sort of in deep revival mode, or about to be in deep revival mode. And it was also the time I grew up in, so I was fascinated with it and with the pop culture. So I did that. I spent a year kind of immersed in the 70s. Actually, as I'm sitting in my office now and I'm looking across at my bookcase, and there's still a Walton's paper doll set up on my bookcase that's left over from that time. But that was a book I, you know, thought I could sell and I thought would be fun to do. So that's how I ended up doing Two at Once. But I really considered myself mostly a fiction writer at that time, though I was doing a lot of book reviews, a lot of interviews, and things like that were more journalistic.
We had two weird experiences about 10 years before you. We wrote a book which I understood was the first book on microcomputer communications for the John Wiley. And John Wiley was used to taking a long time to get computer books out. They just hadn't gotten it yet. There wasn't like mainframe things. They were around for a long time. So it took them a year to get it out. And the friend of mine who had preceded me as the president of the Apple User Group in New York started writing a similar book from McGraw-Hill, and he started it about 6 months after us, and he got it out before. And one of the reviews of our book said it was well written, but Ed did little to what Neil Shapiro said on the subject, and I felt like throwing everything out the window.
Oh no, that's a writer's nightmare.
Then the one that we had a year later, there was the group of us that used to meet for lunch once a month in New York, and we call ourselves the Writers Group. And someone got the idea that we should write, that we should put together an anthology of writing on this new personal computing and web that was going. So not only did we write for it, there was some names you might know, Esther Dyson, Doug Barr.
Oh, yeah.
Joe King, myself, but we reached out to people like Wozniak and Gates, and also to non-computer people like William F. Buckley and Henny Youngman and John D. McDonald, the mystery writer.
Henny Youngman, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, and to Ray Bradbury. Yeah, we had this wonderful book called Digital Deli, and we sold about 20 copies. It was well ahead of its time, and and it was it's online now. Atari has a website of classics, and Esther bought a whole bunch of them, and she sent them to all to subscribers, you know. But we had all these terrific people, and just the timing was wrong. Yeah, so if we had waited, it would have been too late. Around the time of that we're talking about, you also won the fellowship from the National Endowment of the Arts. So, what was involved in both the competition and the award?
For them, I sent in a short story, and I won. Yeah, I won an award. I think it was like $20,000 back then, which was for me a year of living.
Wow!
Because this was the 90s, and yeah, so that was great, and that really helped me transition from being somebody who had a day job to somebody who didn't. And I was kind of off and running then. I was then, you know, doing books and magazine articles and some teaching, and pretty much have been a full-time writer ever since.
There's the Jillian Awards and that you won, and I'll just mention some of them. You may not want to spend any time in them. You won the MIT Science Award from the Knight Foundation Fellowship, the Massachusetts Book Award Honor, the Nonfiction, an award from the Smithsonian, the New York Times Notable Book, recipient of the awards in fiction, of Sonora Review Prize. You should be proud of all this, and obviously.
Oh, well, you're very kind to read all of them. That's music to my ears, hearing all of that. You know, the one that I think made the greatest change in my life was the Knight, MIT Knight Science Journalism Fellowship, which I did in 2010, 2011, and it's a year at MIT. And I had been transitioning. I had been doing writing science, I guess what you would call science journalism, for about 10 years before that, but had, you know, been a bit seat of my pants. And being at MIT for a year, I was given a chance to study anything and do anything. And so I studied mostly microbiology and neuroscience, and it was just amazing. I came out feeling so much more passionate about covering science, and so much more in love with it, and feeling less shaky about doing it, and but also got to meet all my fellows and get close to them. So ended up becoming close to a lot of wonderful colleagues. But that year was amazing, and I just feel so grateful to them, because it was there that I really fell in love with microbiology, which, you know, was just when I was there in 2010 was going through this huge revolution, because, as you may know, you know, we have all these new tools, genomics tools, that are allowing us to see what would have been invisible before, to see all the species that are in, you know, some pond scum or in your belly button or wherever. And that, you know, before about 2006, all of that was pretty much impossible to see. And that's why, you know, we have all this kind of craze about the microbiome, because suddenly we can sample all of these dark spaces, you know, these places we couldn't really understand very well. And we're finding out they're full of these species we've never seen before. And all of that was so exciting to me when I found that out and really immersed myself in it. And it's still really exciting to me. It's a little hard to write about it sometimes because it's so on the geeky end. But I remain a super fan of microbiology, and so that was, you know, really ignited so many passions, and I just got to meet so many cool people. So that was I feel very lucky.
Before you ever even got into that, I know that you had written two novels in the late 1990s. Do you see yourself ever moving, as people like Isaac Asimov and those people did, into science fiction novels, say about microbiology or about?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, I almost feel like it's almost impossible. I feel like the things that are happening now are happening so fast, and they're so much more amazing than anything that could come out of my own mind. You know, it's just so humbling. I just to realize my own imagination is so uninteresting compared to what's actually out there. And I think it's also getting older. You know, you become so much more interested in other people. But it's, you know, with microbiology now and biology in general, I don't know if you're following what's going on with CRISPR, and have you heard of that?
Just a name. I can't put anything on it.
It's a revolution in biology that's as significant as the desktop publishing revolution was, you know, I don't know if it's up there with the internet, but I think it's this technology that's going to change all of our lives. So essentially, for various reasons I won't go into, a couple of scientists figured out how to make a cut and paste system for genes, so that and not only does this tool cut and paste, but it goes and it finds the gene, the place you want in the gene sequence, and it cuts there, and then it takes out what you want and it puts in what you want. Now, it's not working perfectly at this moment, but it works pretty well, and it's already in labs all over the world, and so it has the potential to do things like, you know, say somebody has a very deadly gene, like Huntington's, the gene for Huntington's or something like that, to cut that out of every gene, every cell in their bodies, you know, potentially, and to make these cures. But it's also very frightening and scary, because, you know, the damage you could do with this thing and the viruses you could create are very scary. So I'm just, you know, I feel like I could have never thought of anything like that in a novel. It's beyond, and how it's evolving is just so fascinating to me, and the implications of it, and so I just find it so exciting to watch what's going on in the world, which, and everything, you know, I'm sure you've had this experience, this feeling too. It's just, the events just seem to be speeding up all the time. And I almost feel like a renewed mission as a writer to just keep doing more reporting and you know, helping myself and other people understand just what's happening now in technology and science.
While you've been doing this, you're a columnist for the Boston Globe, a contributing writer for Boston Magazine, and a contributing writer and a columnist for New York Times. And it was all as you were moving even deeper and deeper into this field. Do you want to tell us anything about any of those gigs along the way?
Yeah, you know, I bopped around to many different magazines as editors came and went, and as you know, it's a peripatetic lifestyle, being a freelance writer, so I sort of wrote for different places whenever there was a friendly editor. So I did do a lot of work for Boston Magazine, Boston Globe Magazine. They used to have a profile of a Boston notable, and so that's how I got to. I called up my editor, wanted me to find notable Bostonians to profile, and then one day I realized, you know, Alex the Parrot, who's, you know, it was the African gray parrot who has been studied, was famously studied and knew how to count. And have you heard of him?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, and I realized that Alex the Parrot was living in Boston. So I asked if the celebrity had to be human. And my editor was quite charmed that I wanted to do a non-human, and so he gave me a go-ahead. So I did a celebrity profile of Alex at one point. That was a really fun story. He was really living like a celebrity. He had special handlers that cooked him special breakfasts, and then he had, you know, TV crews coming to film him. So he was very much like living the life of Madonna or something.
I did that once. I wrote a column on a regular basis called I was Deep Rom. It was a tech gossip column, and at one point I interviewed myself. I thought that was funny.
I like that idea. Yeah.
I had you mentioned Boston. The person that was on the show the last week is the weekend host on WBZ, Jordan Rich, who was a very interesting person. You also went back to academia twice to set up writing and mentoring programs at Dartmouth and at the Warren Wilson Graduate Center in North Carolina. What was the motivating factor to get you involved with those programs?
Well, actually, I was teaching writing and began in the 90s at Boston College and was in and out of teaching because it was a steady income, but I also really enjoyed the students. And then Dartmouth in 2009 offered me this gig as they were setting up a nonfiction program there. They didn't have one yet. And which is interesting, like a lot of schools have writing programs, but it's all fiction and poetry, and so much is happening in nonfiction, you know, in literary nonfiction, that a lot of schools are adding that now. So they, I did a year there, but I felt very torn. I was still, you know, fascinated with technology and science at that time, and was walking around campus listening to podcasts about pharmacology or whatever. So I felt a little split. I really wanted to get back to reporting and science and technology.
I think it might be fair to say, and you may disagree, that the culmination of your experience to date, to study, the writing experience, the columns, and the books have come to your present book, in Phenology, how we dream up of things to change the world. Is that the fair statement? And would you tell us about the book?
Yeah, you know, for me, the genesis, the real prehistory of the book began when more than 10 years ago, I did a story on an inventor who's mentioned in the book, Amy Smith, who is such a fascinating person. She was a Peace Corps volunteer and an engineer, and she began realizing she could help people solve these problems they had, like not getting grain mills, for instance, which really changes your life if you live in rural Africa. If she could help them engineer the parts they needed or, you know, make these innovations. And she began teaching at MIT, began bringing all of her students to places like Africa and Haiti so that they would work as partners with local people there in solving the problems of developing nations. And Amy didn't take – she never took a she was always an instructor, so she lived on almost nothing because she didn't want a job. She wanted the freedom. And she would also challenge her students to her students in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where it's, life is quite expensive. She would ask them to live on $2 a day for a week because she wanted them to see the enormous creativity that it takes for people to live when they don't have a lot. And about half the world lives on less than $2 a day. So she really wanted them to begin to think differently and to think in a more, as designers and inventors, in a very empathic way. And Amy's vision really fascinated me because it was a new way for me. She showed me a new way to look at technology as something that belongs to all of us and that is, you know, not just for an elite, but is should be used to design solutions for most people in the world. And that really fascinated me, and I always wanted to really take a deep dive into that. And then in 2012, the New York Times Magazine hired me to do this column called Who Made That? And they would basically have an object like a sippy cup or a smoke detector or a... trying to think of some of the others, catcher's mitt or something like that. And then they would, my job was to find the origin. Who had originated that idea? How did it come to be? And tell the story. So it ended up being almost like this grand research project into how ideas evolve and how, who originates. You know, who comes up with the really newest ideas? And that, as I worked on the column week after week, I began to notice these patterns between the stories. And it was really exciting because I thought, well, I'm beginning to see patterns about how ideas come into being. And it felt very important to try to capture that. And also, I really wanted to talk to other people, you know, like economists and psychologists and so on, and see if they compare notes and see if they were seeing the same things that I was. So that was the evolution of the book for me.
You gave a few pages in the book to one of my intellectual heroes, Vannevar Bush. Having you here gives me the chance to bring him to our audience's attention. Tell us, what attracted you to Bush?
He is such an interesting character. So he was a vice president of MIT back in the 1930s and was working on an analog computer, one of the very earliest computers back then. And the big news back in the 1930s, the big exciting technology was microfilm, believe it or not. But the fact that people could photograph pages of books and shrink them down and store them was really exciting back then. And so Vannevar Bush?
Vannevar, the way I pronounce it.
And so he really began to think back in the 30s, he began to think, well, what could you do if you could when you can shrink down information like this and store, say, the whole contents of a library in a desk, what do you do with that? Like, what use is that? What becomes possible? And he began to think about that very deeply. And he actually, and this is something that was one of the patterns I noticed, which is that many great inventors think like science fiction writers. In other words, they think beyond, far beyond what is possible now. And they think about what human beings would want. And they think about how technology is evolving. So he cast his mind forward and thought, what's going to happen as computers and this shrinking information come together? And he began to imagine a kind of personal library that was as optimized as possible to work with the human brain. So he imagined this sort of desk that had all these books and everything stored on microfilm or something like that, and that you would have a couple of screens on the desk, and you would be able to create information trails and links between the book, pages of the book, and notes. And basically, he came up with, in the 30s, this idea of the personal computer, the internet, hyperlinks, and and just every sort of, he had so many of the ideas that are underlie modern computing. Of course, none of it was buildable. It was really kind of a science fiction imagining that he came up with. But he wrote this piece for Atlantic Magazine called As We May Think, and it was about this science fiction machine called the Memex, which would be perfectly created to be a kind of both a personal assistant and a personal library. And this had, when this appeared in the 40s, it had a lot of effect on a lot of people, and it became almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy because other people read it and saw that this was such a great idea that they wanted to build it. And one of those people was Engelbart, who was, you know, is, I think, Doug known. Engelbart. Yeah,
yeah.
He's known now as the inventor of the computer mouse, but he also was really key in making the first personal computers and pioneering hypertext and word processing and all of that. So, yeah.
Yeah, Bush was interesting, as you say, in that he was Roosevelt's science advisor during the war, and he had both consulting and some authority over both the ENIAC, the first electronic computer, and the atomic bomb as being involved in both of these. And he showed me the difference between the engineer who could do things now and the visionary. One of the creators of the first computer, J. Presper Eckert, was supposedly said, when people asked him, "What are you going to do with these things after the war?" And like all major projects, it was finished too late. It was finished after the war ended, and it was way beyond budget. But he said if we could build 20 or 25 of these, they could do all of the business of the country in for the rest of the century. Now, Bush went the other way. Bush had the article As We May Think, pointing out that we think in the linear fashion, and we read in the linear fashion from the beginning to the end, but we think in dissociative fashion. We jump all over the place. So he really gave us what became the World Wide Web. Now he triggered the imagination not only of Doug Engelbart, but of Ted Nelson, who gave us the term hypertext and made this the lifetime of passion of his, which is still going on. Coincidentally, J. Presper Eckert didn't change my opinion of his ability when he also wrote something for Digital Deli. He was the vice president emeritus of Sperry then, and he started out saying that he doesn't have the personal computer.
Oh,
but
really?
What
year was that he didn't have one?
1984.
Wow.
But he could have one if he had the use for it. And my immediate thing was, "So what the hell did you write this article with?" So the difference between the person who can do something now, and the person like Bush, who was just way out there and took us down this path, was amazing.
Yeah,
I know. that you were striving to find what was common among the many inventors and thinkers about innovation that you interviewed, that, and whether it could be packaged in some way or taught or at least encouraged through research centers or embryos. Did you reach any conclusions?
I did. I actually kind of broke it down into five different, as I called it, stories, five different patterns that I saw. Because, of course, when we say inventing, you know, that encapsulates things, different industries that are really different, you know. So it's very different to design, say, a piece of sporting equipment and a drug, you know, that process is very different, or a computer, you know, all of those, that is very different. So one of the first things I noticed, the first patterns as I was doing this week after week, was that you would think that, I kind of went into it assuming that most things would come out of engineering labs or product designers, because of course those are the people that we pay to come up with radically new ideas. But so many of the completely new ideas, completely new objects that are iconic now, came out of users or people at the front end of a problem who may not have even seen themselves as inventors, who were grappling with some problem. And the person who really opened my eyes to this pattern was this guy named Jake Stapp, who I talked to when he was in his 80s, but many years before, back in the 1960s, he had been a tennis pro running a bunch of camps for kids. And he had to pick up these tennis balls, like hundreds and hundreds a day, and it was basically burning him out and ruining his body. And so much so, and he was continually grappling with the problem, so much so that he began working out the answer. You know, as he was, for months, he was sort of imagining solutions and basically came up with this idea of the ball hopper, which is that wire basket that you put on top of the tennis ball and the ball pops into it, and then you can pick up like 50 balls that way. And that's one of those, you know, in many inventions seem kind of obvious in hindsight, but they aren't obvious at all at the time. You know, it's kind of weird the ball hopper didn't exist until the 1960s. It's sort of like the rolling suitcase, which you would think would have existed forever, but it didn't really come into being until the 1970s. And the one that most of us use today was invented by a pilot. So that's another example of how these user inventors see a problem in, and then they're really motivated to go past a kind of half solution and come up with something really new. So I was seeing that pattern a lot, and in fact,
if I could just hold you on the rolling suitcase, that's interesting, because the airline cart was only used by people with heavy luggage and all this, however, when Compact came out with its portable, and it was a 28-pound portable computer.
Mm-hmm.
That sold airline carts all over the country. So sometimes it's something's developed for a certain thing. Oh yeah, we taught a class at the New School in using the Osborne One, and all of our students had to bring their Osbornes in, and they all brought them in on airline carts. So there are some things that you develop, and all of a sudden there's some completely external thing that wasn't even around then that all of a sudden pushes them out into the marketplace.
Everything that we come up with is very much an environment. You know, it wasn't, I don't think I think the airport suitcase didn't really come into being. It really didn't take off until the 90s.
Yeah.
late 80s, 90s, and that was when flying became, you know, so many people became frequent flyers, and flying became truly a miserable, miserable activity, you know, where you would pay anything to make flying a little easier. And I think that's why, you know, but if airports had not become so horrible, you know, it might not have taken off. So I think that's a really interesting observation that, yeah, these, you know, one technology creates the need for another technology. And we're definitely seeing that now with phones. Like, there's so many spin-off technologies of things that you do on your phone, or just ways to, you know, all the clever ways to package, keep your phone from breaking. And, you know, you see just this kind of Cambrian explosion of things around the phone.
I heard an interview today with Robert Gordon, the author of The Rise and Fall of Economic Growth, the U.S. Standard of Living Since the Civil War. And he feels, for a number of reasons, economic, political, and demographic, that our current development will continue to bring little of enhanced economic well-being to citizens. I know this is somewhat outside of the purview of your writing, but do you see anything in the innovation that you've been writing about that gives you hope that he's wrong?
I'm interested in hearing more about the theory. So he's saying that it won't, that the economy is going to remain very concentrated at the top, that it's not going to benefit most.
It's going to be both concentrated at the top. It's also going to be because of there'll be less people supporting more, that there'll be limited growth. There'll either be higher taxation, or there'll be cutting back of benefits, that in both cases they'll lead to the slow economy.
The consumers, there'll be so many fewer consumers with money to spend, in other words.
Yeah, but. Yeah. So he doesn't see the innovation. He talks about the post-World War II innovation up through the 80s. And then he sees the whole thing slowing to the way it was prior to World War II. And I'm just wondering if you've had any.
Well, you know what I've been thinking about a lot lately is, so, you know, my own field has been shaken by the internet and journalism, you know, I'm not sure if people outside of journalism are aware of just how bad things are, that, you know, at places like the Boston Globe, which was, you know, just celebrated in that terrific movie Spotlight, and but the current Globe is a shadow of itself. So many people have been laid off there. It has no money. There's, you know, so many newspapers are dying now, and unfortunately we don't have, you know, at the same time we have these riches of, you know, all of these people on the internet who are documenting life and doing some really terrific citizen journalism projects, but in terms of getting a job, you know, or holding a job, the employment situation is so bad. And, you know, more and more people are expected to write for free, or, and you know, and just like same things happen in the music industry. And so as I was writing this book, I was thinking about one thing I'm seeing, you know, as I was reporting on this enormous and very exciting explosion of tools that are allowing more and more people to be inventors, like 3D printing, and all kinds of new tools in manufacturing that are making it much easier for people to, and also crowdfunding. And so I was beginning to wonder if the engineers and the product designers were kind of going to go the way of the journalists. In other words, in my world, in my field, there's less and less money to actually pay people to do the job, and more people are doing it for free. And, you know, and there are just, and that's just, there's reasons why that's good and bad for journalism. But, you know, the worrisome part of it is, like, we need to pay people for work, you know.
Yeah, and it's very often the unintended consequences. Like, one of the reasons for the newspaper demise is the Craigslist took something like $600 million a year out of advertising.
Yeah.
Well, if they don't have the money coming in, they're not going to be paying people, you know. And it's all of these things that in the beginning this was, well, you could get an apartment in your neighborhood, or you could do to whatever, to Craigslist, then all of a sudden, bing, just the economic consequences, or the 3D printing about the ability to, as we start getting into more and more binding and materials, to ways that we can build houses. Supposedly, the Chinese have come up with the technology that they can build 10 houses in a day for under $100 each. I mean,
wow.
And if you think of doing that in Africa, where they need housing, or in Haiti after an earthquake. I mean, so all these, they're marvelous things, but what happens to the construction workers? What happened to the fellow who was making $250,000 a year as a vice president of chemical engineering for Kodak? You know, and Kodak invented the digital camera, and they made a bad business decision. You know,
so
all of these things have somewhat shorter time things, from Craigslist 5 years and to newspapers going out, or to digital cameras when they finally started hitting in the late 90s and 2000s and changing the whole industry, where you walk through malls and you don't see any film processing stores, any camera stores, you don't see any music stores. I mean, all those, just ball game over. And what do we do?
That's so interesting, actually. I hadn't thought about, but you're right, all the fine craftspeople who are, you know, making mantles or carvings, or, you know, they're all they cannot compete with a 3D printer. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I also think about how I have no idea what to do. I mean, I think that this is also a wonderful, you know, it's such a mix of good and bad, because I think it's amazing to have tools that are accessible to everybody, and that, you know, tear away the gatekeepers and let people create media and share media. I mean, that's just amazing and wonderful, and it gives us, wonderful, you know, citizen journalism like Black Lives Matter. All of that has been incredible and empowering for people, but it does come with this downside. I don't know what to do. I'm also really fascinated by, you know, you talked about 3D printing and how you think, you know, we talk about kids now, or young people now, as digital natives because they grew up living online. But I think we're going to begin to see these, I don't even know what to call them, but people who, like you said, you know, now you can 3D print, you can make kind of any object you want. Soon we'll have affordable desktop manufacturing. Will sort of be everywhere. And you're going to see,
MIT
grow up with that. Yeah.
MIT, supposing that you've been in there, they've developed an under $1,000 3D printer that will take metallic bindings and interchangeable bindings. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I was actually just talking to an inventor who used to use 3D printing. I mean, people have been using it just to make prototypes, and then they send the prototypes to the factories, and then the factories make the real item. But he said now he makes, among other things, he makes kayak lights, which have all these little parts to them. And he said now the 3D printed part is as good as the one that comes from the factory, and it's no more expensive. So he just can print it out directly. And that changes, that's fascinating, because at that point, if one of his customers, if a lot of his customers say, hey, we don't like this shape or this, you know, the length of this thing or whatever it is, the product no longer has one identity. It can, he can continually, it can morph over time, you know. He can continually change it as he's hearing from people about what they want and how it should look. So it can continually, so we have this idea of like an object being this, you know, mass-produced thing that endures over time, but we may begin to think about products and objects differently as things that are continually changing and morphing.
And we also have the interplay of different technologies. I remember I had, when I was teaching at Marist College, I had a bunch of students who were being interviewed by IBM in different places all over the country. And I, no, at Monroe College, rather. And I had one student who was out in Austin. And they brought him by this lab, and they showed him, this was just on the way out, it was just to whet his appetite, and it was the dark room, and they said, go in there and say lights on, television on, channel 12 on, and then he went in, and sure enough, he said all the stuff. Now, this is stuff now that we take for granted with Siri or with Google Talk,
yeah.
But it used to be that you had to train something to your individual voice, so and you couldn't use the same thing that I did without switching profiles or whatever. So when he came back, I just happened to have the fellow from IBM there who was running this program, and I mentioned these to what he had done in the class presentation. Then the fellow from IBM said, "Well, do you know why we're interested? It's not to go into to compete with Microsoft run Apple in the home market. It's that at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the foreman gets a call that someone needs to rush order. And he walks out of his office to the factory floor and says, make 400. And there's nobody there."
Oh, yeah.
You know, and all of a sudden, you understand this is all coming together, and we don't even know when we're building the robotics or the voice recognition or the video, whatever, that some bright people, they're going to put the whole thing together, and they're going to wipe out workforces in all these different areas, you know? So.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what the answer is, I'm afraid.
So maybe that's your next book.
Yeah. Well, I think somebody smarter than me is going to have to write that book.
I'm not sure about that. So what's next for you then, as long as I brought that up?
I'm happily not working on a book, happily doing shorter pieces, which feels really liberating right now after being kind of in that 200-page zone. It's really nice to do a piece that can be finished in, you know, a couple weeks. So I actually I've been working for the New York Times Sunday Review recently. I really like that section, and just published
too.
A piece there, and I have another piece in the works for them right now. So, yeah, that's been fun.
We've touched a lot of different bases tonight. What else might you like the audience to know about Peggy Kennedy?
I feel you did such a good job of researching my history. I feel like there's nothing left to tell. Look for my piece in the Sunday Review in a couple weeks, because I'm very excited about it. I found a pretty cool story. So hope everybody will look for it and check it out.
Okay, well, thank you, Peg. It's been a real pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much.
A bit of commercial information. My column now appears bi-weekly in the West of the Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair 9/11 Commission Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. The West of the Garden is available both in print format and online at www.westoftheguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmack13.johnmackrants.com. Send any comments to me at the email address I mentioned earlier, johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in the book. Join us next week for columnist Dennis Hamill. And as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silva. Whoa, let's move on out of here.
Wildcat Kelly, looking mighty pale, was standing by the sheriff's side. And when the sheriff said, I'm sending you to jail, Wildcat raised his head and cried, oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wild.